are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcast, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
I'm Wendy Ring with Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up, and episode 2 in our mini-series on transforming U.S. agriculture. Jim Goodman had a 400-acre organic dairy in Wisconsin.
I farmed for 40 years, and all those 40 years, the herd size was right around 45 cows. We did a lot of different things. We sold crops, we sold seed, we sold steers, we sold milk.
And those sales supported two families.
We had pasture like right outside our dining room window, and we always enjoyed it when the cows were in that pasture because they were out there eating when we were eating, and it was a good way to farm.
Good for his family and good for the land.
You're increasing the organic matter and water retention capacity, and we'd have big rains, and our neighbor across the road who's conventional would have the road ditches washed full of dirt, and ours right across the road, not at all like that. So you could see that it was a better way to farm. What really broke our back was the big dairies that milk thousands of cows and don't have them on pasture, and we just couldn't compete price-wise.
Jim's farm was one of the many falling victim to the rapid consolidation of the dairy industry. As late as 2012, the majority of dairy herds had less than 50 cows. By 2017, the majority had over 1,000, and 4 out of 5 dairies that were Jim's size had folded. Though he's no longer milking, Jim hasn't stopped fighting for the dwindling number of American small farms. As the board president of the National Family Farm Coalition and a board member of Family Farm Defenders.
We're getting to a point where there's two kinds of farms. The very small acreages of farmers that do direct marketing, farmers markets, and then there's the ones that are really big, the confined animal operations, to do several thousand or more acres of corn and soybeans as a rotation. And the farms that have really gone out in the last decade or two are those ones in the middle that were moderately sized, pretty much run by family labor. Those farms are now either bought up or rented by bigger farms. And we see that around here all the time.
Farmers trying to be good stewards run up against a system that puts quantity over quality and leaves those trying to diversify pretty much out in the cold. Sally Worley is director of Practical Farmers of Iowa, a statewide group disseminating regenerative farming techniques from the bottom up.
Practical Farmers' focus is helping farmers teach other farmers at a really detailed level how to set their planter or where to order seed, teaching this practical knowledge. And paired with the knowledge is the community that they can reach out to. If my insurance agent isn't covering my high tunnel anymore, they can call up another farmer they know and find a new resource. So that network component is extremely important. Within our membership, farmers are doing things differently, more frequently planting cover crops, a lot more frequently putting perennials on their ground and raising livestock on pasture.
But practical farmers are a small minority of Iowa's 80,000 farmers, and you have to wonder who's being impractical. In today's high-risk environment, the 95% who are non-members have pretty good reasons not to take chances doing new things.
This year in Iowa, we've experienced a derecho, which is an inland hurricane. We've experienced drought.
Last year, there were historic floods.
Farmers are getting fewer. Farms are getting larger, and it's making our farmland and our rural communities more vulnerable.
And the current system of federal farm subsidies and insurance leaves regenerative farmers without a safety net.
Farmers are playing the hand that they're dealt. They're growing 2,000 acres of corn because that's what the market and our safety net systems are set up for. When you raise a crop like corn, you know exactly where you're going to take it, where you're going to sell it. There's price guarantees. There's excellent insurance. It's all scripted out for you. Anything deviating from corn and soybeans, you're kind of on this solo journey. If I was growing corn and were to venture into growing vegetables, the risk I'm taking is exponentially more. Crops such as vegetables are very difficult to insure, and people who are doing things that are not on the commodity market are just taking a lot more risk from the get-go.
About 70% of federal farm subsidies go to farmers growing corn and soy for concentrated animal feeding operations. Only 2% goes to producers of fruits and vegetables. It's a classic case of you get what you pay for. Only 2% of U.S. cropland is planted in vegetables, those things that are supposed to fill up half our plate. Only 5% of the corn and 2% of soy grown by U.S. farmers is actually eaten by people, and 80% of that corn is in the form of sweeteners.
Old MacDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O. On that farm he had some cows, E-I-E-I-O. With a moo-moo here and a moo-moo.
The farms we tell our children about are nothing like the ones which make the milk they drink. And that low price in the store isn't a bargain because it doesn't include the cost we all pay for the damage to our water, to the climate, to our children's futures. So what happened to Old MacDonald? A system of farm subsidies that leads farmers to overproduce corn and soy in a downward spiral of falling prices, which earn them less than the cost of production. And while farmers were occupied in this race to the bottom, agribusinesses, fattened on their diet of cheap corn and soy, merged, bought up, and consolidated, driving small local buyers, processors, and distributors out of business, and gutting rural America in the process. Today, four companies control 85% of the beef market, 70% of the pork market, and 90% of the commodity grain market. And vertical integration means that many own every step of the production process, from animals to feed to processing to sales.
In the poultry industry, a few companies dictate how farmers raise the chickens, what kind of buildings they build for them.
The companies own the birds and the feed.
The chickens have X number of days to get to market weight, and the farmers that do the best get the best contracts the next year. It's what they call a tournament system.
It's the same thing with pork. A Chinese company, Smithfield, the largest pork producer in the world, owns one of every five hogs in America, and familiar brands like Nathan's, Armour, and Farmer John's. These highly consolidated industries pay farmers so little that for every dollar you spent on your last Thanksgiving meal, farmers got less than 12 cents. The market power of these mega businesses is so strong that farmers who contract with them are reduced to glorified sharecroppers.
Farmers are kind of dictated as to what they grow, how they grow it, and who's going to buy it. Corn and soybeans, that's what the entire grain marketing system is set up for. There just isn't places to sell things other than what the market wants, and they want corn and soybeans and wheat.
Jim and Sally both say that farms and rural communities have to regenerate together. It's a package deal because farmers need local businesses to process and distribute the variety of products that come from a diversified farming operation. I asked Sally to close her eyes and imagine what her town would look like in 10 years if Practical Farmers of Iowa succeeds in achieving statewide transformation.
Well, right now, a lot of crops are harvested. So in 10 years, we'll see a lot more green where cover crops are planted, perennial vegetation where marginal farmland has transitioned to pasture, more fruits and vegetable farms, including some perennial crops such as nuts and trees, grocery stores in those small towns, farmers markets that are viable, businesses that are supporting farms, advertising, distribution, trucking, more kids in schools, more families in churches, more social recreational opportunities. That would be what would happen if my magic wand was waved.
While trust busting and changing farm subsidies have to come from the top down, that rural economic revival is growing from the bottom up. In 2004, a group sat around a table in Charlottesville, Virginia, a town of 47,000 in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. It included farmers, grocers, restaurant owners, and the manager of a local university food service. Folks who grow local food and those who wanted local food but were having trouble hooking up. Kristen Swacko was there too, and later became a founding member of the generically named Local Food Hub. Here's what the farmers had to say.
Challenges ranged from liability insurance to not knowing how to do handling and packaging to cold storage to transportation. So there were sort of myriad challenges to them being able to sell into some of these larger markets.
At the same time, would-be purchasers didn't have the wherewithal to deal with a large number of small producers.
So our food hub and many others in communities around the country were really formed to try and solve those issues. It started out with a donated warehouse, a couple of lease trucks, about 10 farms, and a handful of sales accounts. As of 2019, local food hub was doing close to $2 million a year in sales.
This is not some kind of elite boutique grocery operation.
A food system is only as good as it is equitable. And there were large parts of the community that have access to no fresh food, never mind fresh local food. The great thing about food hubs is the ability to be nimble and pivot when things don't work and to try new things that might work.
One of those really successful trials is a program called Fresh Pharmacy. That's pharmacy with an F, which dispenses fresh produce as nutritional therapy.
Health practitioners identify patients who were at risk for diet-related disease but had challenges in accessing good food. They would literally write them a prescription, and those patients would receive a bi-weekly supply of fresh fruits and vegetables, carefully curated to make sure that they were culturally appropriate and low prep or no prep, and accompanied by educational materials. It's a way to eat with dignity. It's just different than getting handouts from a food bank. There were absolutely measurable improvements in blood pressure, A1C levels, BMI. Participants tell us that they've been able to go off one or more of their prescriptions. We also collect a lot of qualitative data, and there are true lifestyle changes. People really are enthusiastic about eating this way, about exploring new foods, and those are things that hopefully last.
When the pandemic hit, the food hub made a smooth pivot and expanded Fresh Pharmacy, dropping the prescription requirement, so partner groups could give bags of produce to those in need. They also organized drive-through farmers markets and hired out-of-work cabbies and caterers to make home deliveries.
I think it met a big demand on the consumer side, and we've been told that it was a real lifeline for a lot of these farms.
5 years ago, Kristen's food hub needed capital to expand, but as a nonprofit, it couldn't get investors. So they sold their distribution network to another food hub called 4P Foods. 4P is a benefit corporation, a for-profit with a social mission. Tom McDougall, founder and CEO, started this food hub single-handed, riding the DC Metro to deliver bags of produce. Today, 4P has trucks for that and over 100 employees. Here's Tom's story.
I'm originally from the Hudson Valley area of New York, and I grew up with farmland all around us, and I worked on one of the neighboring farms, and throughout my childhood and teenage years, the farm all around us was basically failing, and slowly but surely got sold off. My father, the produce guy, worked in small grocery stores, watched as his ability to procure food from local farmers also dwindled. Both as those farms dwindled, but while also the grocery industry consolidated and got bigger and bigger and bigger, and the supply chains sort of turned to more national and international channels. So that had sort of an implant on my DNA, and then I moved to Washington, D.C., and I started volunteering for food access organizations in D.C. It became strikingly clear very quickly that access to good food is very much a luxury. It is not the norm. And in my first career, I spent a lot of time going back and forth to and from China doing manufacturing and then import-export, where I got really a firsthand look at the concept of externalized costs within a global capitalist system. The widgets that we were making had a price, but that price was far lower than all of the true costs, the environmental degradation, human rights abuses. All of this happening while I was going back down a personal rabbit hole of food system education, picking up various books on my plane rides across the planet. I got really fired up about local food and had so many light bulbs go off for me, understanding, oh, that's what happened to my dad's job, and that's what happened to the farm when it got sold off to a developer and turned into a golf course. All of this is what was happening.
So back home in D.C., he joined his first CSA. Community Supported Agriculture is basically a subscription program where you pay a farmer up front for the season and get a weekly box of produce.
And so I fell in love with my CSA and got very passionate about it, but could not, for the life of me, convince any of my friends to sign up for a CSA, despite my best efforts. And it was typical challenges that you would hear from many consumers where they were like, yeah, that local food thing sounds good. It's cool that you get a box of vegetables, but I don't want to go to a farm to pick it up. Or I don't eat kale, no matter how many recipes you give me. Or what the heck do I do with kohlrabi? You know, insert challenge here. And it was sort of the same group of people that would self-proclaim, I love the farmer's market, but then never have time to go. Which was idea number one for launching 4P Food, which is how can we take the principles and values of community-supported agriculture, farmers markets, independent small family farms, and bring it a little bit into the 21st century to meet some of the consumers who want to shop with their values, but the system makes that hard, number one. And then number two, how do we do so in a way that doesn't further marginalize historically marginalized communities and further perpetuate the divide between who has equitable access and who doesn't? And those two things sort of came together to be the mission and ultimately the business model for 4P Foods. So in 2014, we put our life savings in and house on the line to launch sort of a CSA on training wheels and have been at it ever since. We buy food from several hundred farmers. It comes into one of our two warehouses that we have in Virginia.
Customers place their orders online.
We pack it up, and then we have a fleet of vehicles that go out throughout the greater Virginia, D.C., Maryland region.
4P started out selling to individuals and families, delivering to homes, community centers, apartments, and office buildings. And after taking over distribution from the Charlottesville hub, expanded to supply restaurants and institutions.
Our farmers range from a small quarter-acre hobby farmer on up to 800-acre fifth-generation family orchard and everything in between. With many of the farms, we are by far their biggest customer, and our purchases are significant and they matter a lot. With other producers, we're a teeny tiny customer or only buy once or twice a year. So while we're friends and good partners, it's not a game changer for their family. And it really does range, you know, across the board like that. So we buy directly from a network of fruit and vegetable producers, dairy farmers, cheesemongers, pickle makers, meat producers, you name it, throughout the state of Virginia and Maryland, where it makes sense logistically for either us to pick up from them or them to drop off to us. Outside of that radius and outside of prime production months in the Mid-Atlantic, we are one of the founding members of a new network called the Eastern Food Hub Collaborative. And these are food hubs that share our same values around how to source from producers that are good stewards of the land or the animals or the waterways or the community or their soils or all the above. But they're in different geographic regions. Crown of Maine up in central northern Maine, Grow Food Carolina down in Charleston, South Carolina. Up and down the eastern seaboard, there are similar hubs just like us. And we all have different growing seasons. So in January, for example, in our 4P Foods bags, we'll have apples and beets and turnips and pickles from Virginia, but we'll also have grapefruit from a small farm down in Charleston, South Carolina, where we have inter-hub trading happening because they don't have a ton of apples down there, but we have a ton of apples here in Virginia in cold storage.
4P stands for Purpose, People, Planet, and Prosperity. And part of the purpose is to increase access to good food for everyone.
One of the most fun programs we work with is in Washington, D.C., in Ward 7, very much an underserved community relevant to lack of grocery stores. There is a place called the Youth Baseball Academy. It's part of the Washington Nationals organization. It's a big, beautiful, wonderful place for kids to hang out after school, learn about baseball, go to during the summer, and they have all kinds of programming and education, and they've got a garden out back. And we, for the last 3 years, have partnered with them and turned that into basically a pop-up pay-what-you-can farmer's market. So every Wednesday, we show up with our truckload of locally sourced wonderful produce. We take over the concession stand. And so instead of selling on Wednesday evening Snicker bars and soda, there's tomatoes and kombucha and everything else. At the academy, there's a learning kitchen upstairs. So the YMCA, their team comes in every Wednesday, and they run a series of cooking classes built around the CSA, so people can grab their bag, go upstairs, and then for 2 hours they do meal prep using all of the ingredients in the bag. So they go home with whatever roasted cauliflower, but also now the newfound knowledge and confidence to break down and roast cauliflower.
4P provides the produce at cost, which is covered by grants from the USDA and the Ball team. That's great, but we can't solve inequitable food access with charity. With so many folks struggling to get enough food of any kind, it's hard to see how we're going to feed everyone high-priced produce.
Food from these kinds of farmers does not cost more. It's that the food from the industrial system is artificially operating in a system where the price is artificially less. A Big Mac and fries can be $3 at McDonald's, and that's the price. But the cost is paid on our hunger obesity crisis, the number of people with diabetes, environmental degradation that comes with the production of the corn in the Midwest that uses a tremendous amount of fossil fuels and chemicals that goes off into the water, that's removing soil, killing the waterways, making the Gulf of Mexico such that watermen lose their livelihood. There's just an endless ripple effect.
The health and environmental costs of a Big Mac are nearly twice what you pay at the register. Jim Goodman, the dairyman we met earlier, says the solution is to fight for living wages for everyone. John Eichert, an agricultural economist, put it this way when he explained why overproducing food doesn't solve hunger. Markets won't feed hungry people because people are hungry because they're poor. Speaking of the economic crisis and COVID.
COVID changed everything. COVID really fundamentally changed our business, but I think the regional food shed and much, much more. For us, what happened was prior to COVID, about half of our sales were to businesses and about half of our sales were directed to individuals. And the third, fourth week of March, that first half, selling to restaurants and universities, almost completely dried up. So honestly, there was a couple days there where we thought that was going to be the end of the company because you can't lose half your sales and not need to lay off a bunch of people. And then what about all of the farms that do rely on those sales? And it was a scary couple weeks. But we all agreed as a team to try to execute a bit of a pivot and see if we can keep the company alive and keep purchasing from some of those farms that really do depend on us. And then what happened next was just the craziest kind of what has now been 8 months of my life, where our direct consumer side of things just exploded. We went from a team of 22 people to 108 people in a 7 week period. We had to get a second warehouse. We had to turn into a 24 hour operation, packing overnight. So we saved the company, but also we started to buy a lot more from our current producers and also started to work with some new ones. And then somewhere along the way in April, the wholesale sites also ended up coming roaring back because a lot of food access partners started to turn to us as national supply chains began to break and grocery stores started to empty out their shelves. Emergency feeding organizations around the region were looking for food. And thankfully, local regional farmers had food and were in business. So our whole landscape of who was a business-to-business customer. It went from being a university to a food bank or food pantry. It went from being a restaurant to a community feeding organization. Yeah, it has changed fundamentally pretty much everything about how we operate.
Including their delivery methods.
The vast majority right now, we're dropping off at people's front doors, knocking and running away.
Local food hubs give farmers places to sell diverse crops, but they don't by themselves change the way people farm. What are you doing to get farmers to farm more sustainably?
There's the right now answer and then the what we hope to do more of answer. Right now, we very much encourage our farmers to move towards regenerative practices, organic certification, because that's what our customers really value. And so we're passing those values along. So it's a very much one-on-one production planning, relationship-based, human-based conversation. Meeting them where they are now, what are your production practices? And how can we move that a little bit forward towards more sustainability and ideally towards regeneration? Where we hope to go is we're talking with a lot of different partners right now about the economic mechanisms of financially incentivizing and paying them. So many of these producers that are using sustainable and regenerative practices, they are providing a wonderful service to us as fellow humans in the form of carbon sequestration and storage in their soils. But that ecosystem service, they're not getting paid for it. But there is a growing appetite out there to figure out how to not only pay them for those services, but create much larger funding mechanisms to accelerate that so that many more farmers at much greater scale move towards the same practices. And so sort of like the food access conversation, our role as a food hub and as a food network activator to stay in our lane, but to help enable that framework to come together through our direct relationships with the farmers.
With regards to what's in Forpy's lane, I recently interviewed an agricultural antitrust guy who said, you can't change the food system with your fork. Been there, done that, and it didn't work. Does your lane extend to getting farmers and customers to put down their forks and pick up a pen or a phone or maybe in the future a protest sign to advocate for things like breaking up Big Ag and rewriting the Farm Bill?
Yeah, I mean, I hear in your comment that, like, the more you think about it, the more it feels like tax dollars and policy, but we have to change everything. You're right, and that's daunting. But if we're going to change the food system, we have to change every system that it also touches along with it. Otherwise, we won't have systemic change. We need policy change, we need economic change, we need healthcare, education, like we need to change all of it, the Farm Bill being a piece of it. And therefore, we need an engaged citizenry that can help to advocate for that. And so to your question, what is our lane? Do we educate? Do we try to tell our customers, our farmers, to sign on to this bill or to advocate for this thing or to call their congressman or woman? Absolutely. That is part of our lane, is like doing that along with all of the other organizations and food hubs that are doing the same thing. But if we all start to sing the same song, we all become part of a movement. And movements are how systemic change happens.
Tom wanted to leave us with this story.
One of our customers that signed up during COVID was someone who lived in Washington, D.C. and was an activist and knew about the concept of inequity within food access in this country. But then grocery stores started to close and COVID was really scary. And so she found her way to 4P Foods and she signed up for her first bag. And then was sort of anxiously awaiting, hoping that it would show up. And got the newsletter, said it's coming, fingers crossed, I hope it comes. And then we did. We came, we dropped it off at the front door, knocked, ran away. And she got it into her kitchen, opened the bag, and started to cry. And was just sort of overwhelmed. And what hit her later was that the feeling she was actually feeling was food insecure. She wasn't sure if it was going to show up. So for the first time in her life, she actually experienced food insecurity in a way. And wow, like what about the tens of millions of families that experience that every day and have experienced that every day for their entire lives because of the inequities built into our food and economic systems. So to answer the question, if you're a listener, what can you do? I would say don't forget. If your eyes have been opened, if you've had an experience, if you're coming to the conclusion, the accurate conclusion that our food system is broken because our economic system is broken, and that's not right, then don't be one of the folks that is so anxiously awaiting COVID to go away so we can go back to normal. Because normal wasn't working. We need a new normal, and don't forget.
I'm Wendy Ring, and that was Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. If you're ready to act locally or just want to hear a good news for a change, you'll find more great stories on our podcast or at cool-solutions.org. Thanks to our guests, Jim Goodman, Sally Worley, Kristen Swacko, and Tom McDougall, and to Scott Holmes, Track Tribe, Dan Leibowitz, and Matt Keefe in the Bowties for our music.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
Good morning. It's a whole new year, and here's a new episode of Film at 11 on Community Radio KBOO Portland. This week we take a look in depth at a popular anime film and that genre. We celebrate a movie that celebrates a film director, and we have some new movie updates. But first, let's take a quick survey through four or five of so many of the movies that have come out over the past few weeks, mostly on streaming. Let's start out with Wonder Woman 1984, or WW 1984, as the title reads on the screen.
This world is not yet ready for all that you will do.
The time will come, Diana. and everything will be different.
Well, it's a mess. A comedy superhero movie with a fish-out-of-water premise right out of the decade of movies in which the story is set. It is also 2.5 hours long with a coda cameo in the end credits, and with a plot grouped around an ancient amulet that grants